Welcome to the Philacrosophy Podcast, where host and lacrosse expert Jamie Monroe will do what he does best, talk about lacrosse. Each episode will provide listeners with education, insights, stories, and lessons about the lacrosse world. We will discuss current events, coaching, philosophies, and college lacrosse recruiting. Now let's get started with your host, Jamie Monroe.
How's it going, everybody? Really excited to welcome Will Corrigan to the Philacrosophy Podcast. Will is the new offensive coordinator at Air Force. And Will, could not be more fired up to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jamie. Long time coming. I've always listened to these and been very excited, always hoping to hop on here with you. So excited to be here.
Well, here we are. All right. This journey portion is going to be quite interesting because our paths crossed early on, but you are a coach's son. Start us out on your lacrosse journey as the son of Notre Dame head coach Kevin Corrigan and what it was like to grow up, watching that program and eventually playing in that program.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was, I think anybody who's a coach's son or has a coach in the family knows that the work-life balance isn't always easy for a coach, right? Because you pour so much into it, and every coach I know does just that. But the cool part was growing up in South Bend in kind of a smaller town, and having Notre Dame as kind of my personal playground as a kid. So as a really little kid, I used to go over to practice, and they'd be in Loftus, and I didn't give a care in the world about lacrosse, but I'd go play on the gymnastic mats. I'd go, the pole vaulting mats, me and my friends, I'd invite like a couple friends and we'd just go run around the track and we'd go hop on the mats. And that evolved into, as I got into high school and I got more serious about lacrosse, watching practice intently, staying after and shooting with goalies or hanging out with guys. I remember specifically, they had a 6 a.m. practice one time because they got in trouble, and that's the only time that they would practice in the morning. And I was there. I like got a bagel sandwich and went to 6 a.m. And they're like, "What the hell are you doing here?" I was like, "This is awesome! Like, hey, what do you mean you guys practice in the morning?" I was there for an hour before I went to school, but it was so cool. I learned so much. Obviously, it really helped me to be the player I am. It certainly helped me be the coach I am. And having my dad's one of seven, and multiple of his siblings are in the sports world too. So I've learned from them in different capacities. I'm extremely lucky. I wouldn't trade it for the world, man. It's a great, great life to grow up in. And I'm hoping to give my kids the same thing.
Yeah. Amazing. I feel like coming out of the Notre Dame program in many ways is preparation for being a coach, just as a player too. So how was that a factor in your ability to get on the field, be a leader, get better? Just the fact that you were kind of, in this mix your whole life, but also then getting to really do it as a player. And what did you learn from that?
Yeah, I think, I remember after I had committed, to play there, I was talking to Kevin Anderson, who was the volunteer at the time. And I was like, "Hey, like, kind of what should I?" I was at practice. Obviously, I went to every practice I could, I asked him like, "Hey, what do I need to do? What should I kind of, what should I expect coming in this?" And he's like, he kind of just put it in perspective, something that I should have realized to begin with. He's like, "You've been around this your whole life. Like, you see the pace of play. You understand what practice is like. Like, this shouldn't be a shell shock for you like it is for a lot of guys." So I think, growing up around, the way that they play is my dad really values high IQ guys. I don't think that's a secret. I think they've had a lot of guys who have been really successful, who are good athletes, but are better lacrosse players and really smart lacrosse players. And I like to joke that, that was my role, was just to, if you've seen Kicking and Screaming, was to pass the ball to the Italians. My job was to pass the ball to Sergio Perkovic and Matt Cavanaugh and, Connor Doyle and Nick Osello, the All-Americans on the field, right? I was there so to be on the field because I didn't need the ball. And I think that's something I learned, growing up with a coach who really wanted to win and coach the game the right way. It was, making winning plays, not plays for yourself. And so, if you have guys like that on the field, then, you can be really successful. And luckily, we We went to, three Final Fours, one national championship, unfortunately lost to your Pioneers in the Final Four and one of them in overtime. But no, we had a great 4 years, my class, and I like to think that I helped contribute to that.
No doubt. All right, what summer was it that you that we spent the summer coaching together?
That was awesome. It was summer after my sophomore year.
Summer
moved to
2013.
Denver. I think it was summer of 2013. Yeah, moved to Denver, drove out from South Bend, and just shadowed you. Learned a lot. I obviously it's great having a coach in the house, and he's always been kind of the number one mentor for me. But after that, I would say you were my next biggest mentor in becoming a coach. All of my buddies were doing internships in New York and kind of going the business route, which was probably the smarter route because they're actually making money. But I moved to Denver to work with you and follow you around. And I got to coach your son, Colin. I got to coach a bunch of guys who had really successful college careers. It was awesome. And I loved every second of that. There's still people to this day that I keep in contact that I met that summer. Skylar Hopkins actually just reached out to me. His goalie from Moran Academy just committed to Notre Dame. He was texting me. I was like, it's so crazy. That's where our relationship started, was at one of those 3D box elite box field hybrid camps in CU Boulder.
That was fun.
So
it was kind of interesting too, because I kind of viewed your dad, he was a little older than me, so I viewed him sort of as a mentor for me as a young assistant coach. When I took the job at Denver, I stopped off at the brand new Joyce Center in August 1998. Of course, then we competed against each other, and it was a little bit of a different deal, but then it was really cool. Then Kevin ended up recruiting Colin. I ended up, spending a summer with you, basically created an internship, a coaching internship, to get you experience in a lot of different things. We had a pretty good little team then, too, didn't we?
We did. It was awesome. There was, there was a lot of good people. Like I said, a lot of good people I still keep in touch with. Rowley, who's still doing it. Guys, I learned a lot from and wouldn't trade that. And then did it the next summer. Didn't live there full time, but still was coaching with you and that team. No, I learned a ton. You really helped me. I got to coach the defense for the first time because you were kind of coaching the offense. So I did that for the first time. I learned a lot about that. And you helped me, kind of learn to stick up for myself, but also be kind of the bad guy at times, which you have to do as a coach, right? I'm more of a kind of a happy-go-lucky guy and really positive guy, but at times you have to put your foot down. You have to say, that guy can't play. He's killing us out there. Or you have you have to learn to do that as a coach, and you really helped me develop that, which I still think about to this day.
Yeah, and you helped your boy Charlie Leonard get to ND.
Love my guy Charlie. Absolutely, absolutely. Unabashedly take credit for that. I demanded. I was like, Kev, I don't know what he's going to do for you, but he's going to help you in some way. And he did. He turned himself into a really good face-off guy. He worked his ass off. And now he's a great coach, man. He just won. What a weekend for him in May. His alma mater wins the national championship, and then he wins the national championship as a coach at Northwestern with your daughter.
That's right.
Great weekend all around.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And, I do have to say, I'm pretty sure that me and Colin beat you and your dad in 2-on-2 basketball at one point.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that. We can end the podcast now. It shakes me to my core that I lost that basketball game in your backyard. It really does. It's something I think about probably once a month. Kev was shooting too much. He won't listen to this anymore, so I'm going to blame it on him.
Hey, so you ended up having sort of an interesting path post college. Let's talk about that. I mean, you went the high school route and went out the club route, high school route out in the Pacific Northwest. Talk a little bit about how that path has been for you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So after I graduated, I moved to Seattle and was fortunate. I was the head coach and program director at Woodinville. It's a town kind of outside of Seattle. It's kind of right, if you've heard of Bellevue or Mercer Island, it's kind of in the same conference. It's on the east side of Lake Washington. I coached for Cityside Lax, and Drew Snyder and Chris Snyder kind of really helped me with that. Drew Snyder played at Maryland, is from Seattle. He was starting a club program out there. And so talking with my dad about what I wanted to do kind of post-college, I knew I wanted to coach, right? I kind of always knew that that's the path I wanted to go, but I just didn't the traditional path was to go be a volunteer somewhere. And that's just not, I wanted to do something different. I wanted to have kind of more responsibility and ownership of something. And I wanted to, I'd spent 23 years in South Bend. I wanted to go someplace different and have kind of a cool experience. So I was lucky enough that Drew kind of reached out and he helped me get the Woodinville job. And that was such a steep learning curve. I still probably credit that 2 years, as kind of the biggest learning curve I've ever been through, because I was a 23-year-old, kid, and I was now in charge of this program, kindergarten through high school. I was coaching a varsity high school game on Friday nights. And then I was, doing the bobblehead kindergartners, scoop, teaching kids how to scoop and basically babysitting on Saturday mornings. It was just an awesome, I went from this super high level of Division I lacrosse to then teaching kids in a non-hotbed area of like, all right, you have to develop. You can't teach kind of the ins and outs. You can't teach, necessarily how to come off a screen and read that right away. I gotta teach guys how to catch and throw a little bit more, and I gotta get the basics down and then can progress to the higher levels. And we got there by the end of my second year. I was so excited what we were doing. I still, a great opportunity presented itself to go to WNL, to Washington and Lee, but I wish I could have stayed another year in Seattle because we were building something really cool. And I still keep in touch with the guys there. And I think the biggest thing that I learned while I was there was not the coaching aspect. It was kind of the business aspect of coaching, right? Like, there was dads, there was, guys who run their own companies. They were volunteering and helping me, but I'm in charge of them. So they're looking at me like, you better have your shit together or, we're not going to listen to you, right? Like, yeah, lacrosse, you have this pedigree, but you got to prove that, right? We don't care who your dad is. Like, you're coaching our sons, right? We're investing this time. It was not a sanctioned sport by the school. So we had to fundraise for everything. If you're going to be taking money from all of these parents and kids, like, you really need to have your stuff together. So I learned a ton about that. And Andy Farrington was the guy who kind of hired me and mentored me. He'd be kind of the third guy that I would mention, as a mentor. And he really challenged me. Like, he held my feet to the fire. I remember after year one, he was like, hey, you did a pretty good job. We need more out of you. Like, all right, you're a year into this. You've learned, we need more out of you. Like, we hired you to do this. We're paying you X amount. This is what it is to run a business and a program. And I was like, okay. It didn't scare me. It didn't, I wasn't upset about it. I was like, you're right. I gotta be better. Right. I can't be a typical 23-year-old because I'm in charge of these people. I gotta be more mature. I gotta be better about, coaching. I gotta, take on more things because I was kind of the head of the program. So it was tremendous. So then from there, I go to Washington and Lee and Coach McCabe, who's been there forever, was awesome. Eric Koch was the other coach, is still a guy that, is a dear friend of mine. And learned a ton there because I got to help with the offense and Coach McCabe was so great about giving me a ton of autonomy in doing stuff. I ran the box for the first time, which is, I would recommend every young coach run the box because I think you learn a ton about the game. You have a real impact on the game, right? If you're not running a side of the ball, it's really kind of the next biggest piece of a game is subbing and helping in the ride and clear. And you can really do it really well. I know Ryder Garnsey does it for my dad, and he's talked a lot about it. He talked about it on a podcast or an interview, like how exciting it is when you create transition or when you ride the ball back, how you feel like you have a part of that. It's awesome. I also learned to coach faceoffs there. We needed a guy to work with faceoff guys. I thought I was really good at it because we had an All-American at it. It turns out, you need dudes. You quickly learn that in coaching period. You just need good players, but learned a ton about that. And was cool to go kind of high school Division III, and then, got an opportunity to go with Jerry Byrne to Harvard, who coached me at Notre Dame, and I respected and is a unbelievable coach. He just knows the game and he knows how to run a program in a really unique way. So I was there for 4 years before I came here, and I'm super excited. So it's been an interesting kind of different path, which I loved, and that's kind of what I wanted. Is I didn't, I am lucky enough, to have a pedigree, and I'm not going to sit here and deny that hasn't helped me at times, but I've really worked hard to kind of create my own, you know, name for myself in this profession, and worked really hard to not just be the guy who's Kevin Corrigan's son, to be a guy who's a hard worker and a learner and a guy who, you know, people want to be around.
Yeah. Awesome, man. You know, what's really interesting too, is I feel like you have a very unique ability to coach both sides of the ball. I mean, I know you haven't really coached a lot of defense, but we both know that you know defense well. And that's how do you feel like having such a strong defensive background from having been a coach's kid and the great defenses that you've, you know, played on as a player, learned in the mentorship from your dad and Jerry and all that?
Yeah, I you know, it's something that I kind of said to myself at an early age of coaching. And it's also why I wanted to go be kind of a head coach of a high school program right away was, you know, seeing my dad and all the best coaches I've been around, they coach both sides of the ball. They have a at least, you know, not just a toe, but they have a foot in everything that goes on the field, off the field, obviously, but on the field, you know, my dad was coaching, you know, he could stop a play and coach the ride. He could stop a play and coach the clear. He could coach the offense. He could coach the defense. So everybody on the team felt valued, right? Because the head coach is going to be able to coach you up and give you a pointer during practice, right? I think that's a really important thing just for guys on the team. When you have a 50-man roster, a 55-man roster, and three coaches on the field, or now four, right? It's hard to kind of have a relationship with everybody, especially for the head coach, right? And if the head coach is just talking to, you know, half the team, then I think that that's hard at times. So I really wanted to be able to coach everything. You know, being with Jerry and my dad, they always emphasize defense first. As a midfielder at Notre Dame, you have to play defense, right? I remember, you know, playing in Denver, ironically, against Albany my senior year and getting matched up with Lyle Thompson. And it wasn't like our team panicked. You know, it was like, we've all practiced defense. We all know what to do. And you know, that's just how, you know, it goes, right? The defense obviously knew, all right, we're probably going to need a slide, but it wasn't like they were changing the defense around this matchup because it was something they were super worried about. He didn't score, by the way. I want that to be noted. But you know, that's a really important piece. And you know, Coach Byrne was great. He kind of gave me a ton of autonomy in the ride. So I learned really how to develop the ride, and not just from a macro, you know, 7-on-6 perspective or 10-on-10, but developing drills like, and he would push me on it, on like, hey, we need to get better at this specific part of the ride, come up with a drill for that. Or he would tell me like, what do we need to get better at? Not just riding, but do we need to get better at, you know, the ball pressure from attack? Do we need to get better at our middies bumping? Do we need to get better at communication? Are we giving up transition? So we needed to drop better. So we'd come up with drills for all of that. And so, you know, that's kind of how I've always taught. My dad and the people I've learned from have always taught is these kind of piecehole drills, right? You take a section of the game that you feel like you need to get better at, and you develop a drill to get better. And so through face-offs, through riding, I've now had, you know, a ton of autonomy in both of those. Now I have the opportunity to, you know, I've helped with offense everywhere I've been. And now I have an opportunity to really, you know, have autonomy of that. Coach Wilson's been great about that here at Air Force. And then, yeah, so defense, you know, I'd love to at some point, you know, coach that side of the ball, but maybe it's just, you know, hopefully when I'm fortunate enough to become a head coach, I can get to have my hands there. And Jerry was great about it at Harvard, is I would be able to coach both sides. He would sometimes leave me on one end of the field with a whole group and just say, yeah, you know, you can, you know, our defense, you know, Coach Hutch has trusted you with some of the offensive stuff. Like, you can handle that. And, you know, Coach Hutch and I will be on the other end. And Coach Bergman obviously would be there with me too. A great friend and coach as well. So, yeah, I really love coaching both sides of the ball, and I think it's really helped me as a coach.
Totally. What, talking about riding a little bit, can you explain the roll-up concept in riding?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. We just went over this with the staff, here at Air Force, kind of explaining it and seeing if we can work it in here. Cause I think it's really valuable. We did it really well, the past couple of years at Harvard. It helped us riding a lot. So the concept basically is you're going to pull the two closest guys off the field. And so a lot of times that might be a midi and an attackman, right? Because an LSM and a close defenseman are going to sub. And so the guys matched up with them are often a midfielder and an attackman. And so it helps you know, every team is kind of taught clear opposite box side. You have your D middies stretching opposite box side. And, you know, a lot of teams, if they sub two middies, you can create a two on one because you have one offensive middie dropping. You have two O middies all the way on the other side of the field. And so that becomes really difficult, right? Like you, if you can get push the ball up the field, you can create a two on one. So essentially what the roll up is you have two offensive middies are able to drop. You have the attackman subs off and you have a D middie who subs on for him. The LSM comes on for the O middie. D middie comes on is an attackman. And then as the ball swings back, because there is no advantage opposite box side, when the ball now swings to the box side, you roll up the offensive middie who comes in, becomes an attackman. And the D middie now is a middie, and now there's no advantage on that side either. So that's the general gist of it. Yeah, I think a lot of teams are doing it. It's not like that's some secret. A lot of teams are doing that. I just think we did it really well. It's something that the box coach has to be aware of. I know Ryder does it really well, and you have to kind of be cognizant of how and when to do it. You know, because you don't want guys looking to roll up because then they stop riding. They're just looking to stop playing defense and to stop riding. They just want to become attackmen. But no, it's a really valuable way to ride. And like I said, our guys at Harvard did a great job. I think we were third in the country last year in you know, riding percentage, and hoping to kind of do that here. Coach Wilson's been great about, you know, wanting to pick my brain on that and yeah, use me there as well.
Yeah. Well, usually, you know, when you want to ride, it's hard to sub. And so really it allows you to ride and sub. You can stop the initial off bench with two old middies, and you're going to get one of those guys off by subbing the way you are. It's really cool. And how does it work with bumping into 10 mans?
Yeah. So I, you know, you can do it 10 man or not 10 man. I mean, the 10 man, essentially what you do is you're bringing a guy, you know, up the field, a defenseman up, and you just have an extra guy there. Right. So we would do it. A lot of times if we were going 10 man, honestly, we would only sub one guy because, you know, if you're in 10 man, you're leaving the goal open, you're giving up that advantage. So you need to get ball pressure and you need to be able to take upfield passes away. So if you sub two guys, you go, if you sub two guys with their two guys, you know, you're, you know, what's that, seven on, you know, you're 7-on-6, and then you're kind of, you know, 5-on-4 for a bit until everybody kind of comes back on. There's still no advantage. But if they sub two and you sub one, and you bring a defenseman up, now you have an advantage, or at least you're matched, you know, you're matched up with everybody. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important is, you know, how you sub in that, and you might be able to sneak the guy off. If you have an attackman who kind of rides to the, too near the box and the ball is opposite, and you can sneak him off and get a guy on, or you can bump an omitty through. You know, and the other thing is if they only sub one guy, then they have an extra pole on the field and they've got to clear now with three poles instead of four midfielders. You know, it creates an advantage there. The roll up doesn't have to be done in a 10 man scenario. Obviously it can help, but it can be done kind of in any riding scenario.
Love it. All right, let's switch gears. Let's talk a little player development. How psyched are you to be able to have your own plan to develop players in the way you want to? And can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to do, how you're going to do it?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it. Obviously, I've thought about it since, you know, basically I was at WNL and I was working with the offense a lot, but wasn't, you know, running the offense. And then, you know, working with Coach Hutch, I learned a ton. But again, you know, was taking notes on what I would do, you know, what I'm going to, you know, take from him. I even talked to your son, who, you know, Colin's now the offensive coordinator at Colgate, which I'm psyched for him. And he's in the same boat as me. He's you know, got this opportunity for the first time and probably has a depth of ideas that he's been thinking about since he was a player. So we talked the other day for about 30, 40 minutes about how we're going to develop players. And I'm super excited to the individual development, kind of the team development. I think, you know, I think something you brought up to me a while back, and I know you've talked about, you have a great podcast on it and you talk about with a lot of guys, is kind of, you know, what are fundamentals, right? And your fundamentals are basically what you decide they are, right? It's, you know, you typically think it's passing the ball overhand, it's shooting the ball overhand, it's stepping with your left foot and when you're throwing right-handed. That's what the traditional fundamental is. But really what fundamentals are is what you value as a program, right? And what you value as an offensive coach. So, you know, I'm certainly excited. I think, you know, being at a spot like Air Force, we have a lot of really good players, really skilled players. So I want to develop our kind of two-man IQ. I want to develop, you know, you have to be great shooters. You have to spend a lot of time shooting and shooting on goalies, right? It can't just be, you can work on some form stuff early on, but you have to shoot on goalies. You know, if you, obviously you don't want to pelt goalies too much, so you can use tennis balls, but you have to get used to that kind of pressure of catching the ball and seeing where to finish the ball. And then, you know, you build from there. I think the big thing I've learned from you, from Jerry, from my dad is, you know, to develop guys, you develop the skills, but you want to develop decision makers. And so to do that, even when you're doing kind of offensive drill work, you have offensive guys playing defensive roles. So there's there's the value that the offensive guy then sees what the defense sees. And I think there is value in that. I haven't seen a ton of value. Like, I don't think that's like the number one value. I think the number one value is that you just have an offensive guy making a decision with a guy across from him, and you can make it as competitive. You can make it as scripted or as, you know, less scripted as you want, but you're making decisions. You're reading a guy and you're constantly doing that. So the skills you're getting, you know, you're developing your skills, but you're developing the mental decision-making quicker. And that's something that we're putting a lot of value on. We do some quick stick work every day without any pressure, just to kind of get warm and, you know, get a feel for your stick, right? You want to get out there and get your body loose, but almost everything we do after that has some sort of decision-making component, some sort of, you know, competitive component. You know, and I think that's been really valuable. I'm kicking myself because we've been not great shooting the last couple of days, and it's on my fault because we haven't shot on goalies much. So we need to shoot on goalies more in some capacity. And, you know, whether it's we're shooting on goalies when we have the defense with us, but in the skill work, we have, you know, the goalies are getting their skill work and getting warmed up, but they want to see shots too. That's how they get better. Yeah. So that's kind of been the thought process. You can tell I'm still a little scatterbrained. I haven't kind of formulated the step-by-step building blocks, but I have the overall thought of what I want us to be really good at and what I want us to continue to get better at.
Well, that's just it. There really isn't a step-by-step, and that's one of the exceptions about, you know, fundamentals. You're talking about fundamentals as what you value. Therefore, fundamentals is more conceptual. It's not a technique. Yeah. You cannot, as you say, the decision-making is so key, and you can't really separate the decision from the technique. But the technique used is a decision based on the situation, which is why people, you know, Brian McCormick, the basketball.
He's great.
Talks about fake fundamentals. You know, when you say this is what you need to do, like overhand passing, for example, well, is that really a fundamental? Does that actually, is that what should happen? And, you know, the quick examples are, well, if you're drawing and dumping, you're not really going to be able to draw somebody into your hands and into your stick and throw it overhand, or you'll throw it into their stick. You have to throw it around them, whether it's shooting, passing, faking. Same thing with under pressure. If you're getting a ton of pressure and you're trying to kill a game, you can't just throw overhand passes when they're beating the crap out of you and putting their stick right in where they think you're going to throw it. So it is refreshing to hear you talk about it. Back to the decision-making thing, I think a lot of people sort of think of decision making as we need great decision makers, and they think of it more in terms of game management, which of course is a part of it, but literally everything you do on the field, everywhere you go, everything you do, everything you say, everywhere you look, it all becomes decision making. Everything is decision making. And that's the part that I think sometimes people don't really think about.
No, I completely agree. And I think, you know, like I said, learning from Jerry and my dad a ton, you know, they coach every part of the game and every decision you make from the moment you step on the field as a clearing middie or a riding middie. You need to know what's going on. You know, you're making decisions there. Who are you communicating with, right? That's why you have to be engaged on the sideline. That's why the attack have to be engaged from the moment the ball is turned over, right? And the ball is going to come down towards them. There's, you know, there's decisions everywhere, right? And you're never going to make 100% of them right. Something we talk about a lot is making them, you know, decisively, right? You want to make decisions. You don't want to kind of waffle or kind of halfway, you know, make a decision, because it's hard for everyone to make a decision after that, right? Like every kind of possession and every offensive and defensive possession, ride clear, is a series of decisions. if one guy in that chain is waffling, the next guy can't make his decision until that guy does, right? So you just need to make, even if it's maybe the wrong or not the perfect decision, if you make it quickly, it's a great thing, right? It's a great thing for the team. And then you go back and film, then you go back after the play and you said, hey, love that you made it quickly. This was a better option. That was still a good decision. You know, now let's look for, right? Then you teach what's the best option. But the first thing I think that you really want to teach is making decisions quickly, right? You just want to be able, because you want to keep the ball moving and you want guys to feel confident. You want guys to feel like the ball is going to come back to them when you give it up, right? If guys aren't sharing the ball, it's hard for them to make a quick decision or to give the ball up if they don't feel like it's going to come back to them.
Yeah, great segue into talking about your offense. So what kind of offense are you going to run, and what are the main sort of principles or themes or things that you value that will become your fundamentals in your team offense?
Yeah, it's I talked to Colin a lot about this, and I've kind of been taking notes. I have a big Excel doc that I started, I think at WNL, of just like stuff I liked, whether it was scouting, whether it was stuff we did, and I was like, "Ooh, I liked that drill." Stuff I thought of that I didn't do, but was like, "Ooh, this would be an interesting drill to run one day." Stuff that and then carried it over to Harvard. I think the main thing is teaching guys how to play, like we've talked about. Like that's the most important part. So the offense is sharing the ball a lot. The offense is really good spacing. Is creating really quality looks. And quality looks are sticks to the middle of the field. You'd like to be inside the hashes, and you'd like to be 12 and in, depending on who the shooter is, right? You have some guys who can stretch the field at 13 or 14. Most guys are going to be 12 and in. You know, hopefully don't have a bunch of guys like me who are 8 yards and in. It's hard to play offense that way. So that's kind of the first thing is teaching guys how, and you want to teach the different, the fundamentals, right? The stuff that I've deemed are valuable to our program, right? So the footwork on how to clear through, the footwork on how to pop behind the ball, the footwork on how to, set a pick, right? And how to move off ball, how to cut away from the ball. The stick work of how you throw it to a guy in a when he fades or a lead me, right? Which actually is something that I think I took from you and Denver back in the day. They were so good because it was a bunch of Canadians. They wouldn't change hands when they would fade in front of the ball. They would just kind of put their stick downfield towards the goal, and it would kind of lead them down towards the goal. I think it was something that was really hard to guard and was really valuable. So little things like that, teaching them how to play and how to give each other space. And then the what, right? The specific actions. That's where I'm still kind of figuring out what we want to do. I've really liked what some people have done in the past. I really like what Princeton does. I really like what Hutch did with the offense at Harvard. I liked Jim Mitchell then was coaching the Cannons, and I was talking to Matt Cavanaugh a lot. He's still a friend of mine, and saying how much he liked what they were doing. So there's some elements of that I want to incorporate. But the big thing is teaching them kind of the skills, and then making quick decisions, and then developing that kind of skill of decision making quickly, and then the right decisions, and then really sharing the ball. Like I really think I loved, there was a great article, it might even been around the book The Inner Game of Tennis, that I know you and I both love, but there was an article about Steve Kerr and the amount of passes that the Warriors kind of made once he got there, right? And they led the league. They kind of shattered records. It was a stat they had just started keeping, but just their team passing. And I think to get kind of meta here, I really believe that the ball has energy, right? And you just kind of feel it when the ball's humming and you're sharing it, everyone just kind of feels it and they want to share it again. And they just, you just kind of know when the right opportunity is there. Right. But when you're not, when a guy dodges and holds the ball for 7 or 8 seconds, and then he gives it up, and that guy holds it for 3 or 4 seconds, right. You just kind of, everyone kind of slows down. Right. But if the first couple of dodges of a possession, the first couple of passes are crisp on a guy's ear, ball moves, ball changes fields. That's what we really want. And everyone is just going to kind of feel involved in the play. Right. And you're going to get kind of a lot of good action. And then it's something that I'm a huge NBA fan, and I love reading about it and watching it. And I really think I love the way that they run offense, and obviously their shot clock's a lot shorter, but I love that there's a starter action and then they're just kind of playing from there. They've developed where guys should be on the floor. It's usually some sort of starter action to get a guy in a specific spot and let him go to work, or to get a specific pick and roll look. So all of that, the pick and roll is a lot like the two man in lacrosse. It's not necessarily a pick and roll, but that's oversimplifying the NBA too, right? There's picks and pops. They'll involve a third guy. The way that the ball carrier can manipulate a defense and the picker. So we're working on stuff like that, but I really like the idea of having starter actions that, you can throw in the week of a game, right? Something new and just to create, it's not going to create a shot necessarily, but it might create a matchup. It might create a really good dodging opportunity for your best guy. It might create two guys in a scenario that are going to, be able to create some offense. And then we're just playing from there. Then we're using the how and the skills that we've talked about and kind of the principles and going from there. So that's a long-winded way of saying kind of what we're trying to do this year.
Love it. Dive a little bit into two-man game and how you sort of like to teach it, how you view it, what percentage of the time you think you'll be setting picks for the ball. And then I want to talk off-ball two-man too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm all ears on the off-ball two-man. I haven't dove into teaching that as much. And I've listened to some of your stuff, and Colin has a great webinar, excuse me, that he sent to me that I haven't listened to yet. But in terms of on ball two man, I don't know the specific number, right? But I know we want to do it a good amount. I think it promotes ball movement, right? Because I think immediately after you come off of a pick, there's two guys there. And if you get something great, obviously you're going to go to the goal and score. But more likely than not, you're going to either throw back or you're going to throw forward right away because you've drawn a third guy. And it just promotes ball. It's not one guy dodging and then having to read essentially a 5-on-4, right, on the backside and try to find the one guy. It makes it a little easier, and you're just not going to get a great shot from the ball carrier a lot of times, right? Some guys can, and they can manipulate the defense with their footwork, and they can use hesitations and pumps and get to where they want to be. But I think it really promotes sharing the ball, and that's something I really value. So we're doing a lot of stuff, like I said previously, with guys guarding, with our offensive guys playing defense, whether it's a 2v1, whether it's a 2v2, practicing the way guys are going to play picks, and then how we adjust to that, right? If guys are going to hard hedge, if guys are going to, if guys are going to jump switch, if guys are going to jump double, if guys are just going to kind of soft switch. We're kind of developing that right now, the IQ of, all right, what does it look like off of each one of those, right? What should the picker do? What should the ball carrier do? What's his footwork there? And then just the skills, right? We probably got to get better at the decision-making and adding that in, but just the skills and the footwork of reading what pick is coming at you and what the defender is doing is something we're working on a lot.
Yeah, I love it. Have you heard of the terminology of AAA ratings?
I've heard it from you.
Yeah. I learned it from Alex Sarama. That's a terminology that he uses, always arrive alone. It's a topic that you hear a lot I've heard a lot on podcasts. Brad Ross talked a lot about it. We're trying to set picks where we don't allow the defender guarding the picker to be in position on time to communicate, to read it. And by putting the picker in a really difficult, quick decision, can't see it, have to react, it takes them out of position to do what they're supposed to do, starting with communication and then, switching or staying or stacking and whacking, whatever it is, all of that. It just makes them late. And I've really taken this to the ball carrier. I was like, why don't we have a AAA rating for the Dodger too? Because the biggest problem with most two-man game is it's predictable. If you just you waddle down and set a pass down, pick down, and the picker's in position defensively, and same thing with the Dodger. If you just kind of predictably use a pick, it makes it so much harder. And if you can actually get both the picker and the Dodger to do something off script, something creative, something unpredictable. This is usually when you see two-man games that work really well and the defense screws it up. It's because one or both of those things happened. Yeah. Just there's endless ways of doing it. But I was curious if you've given that much thought, because that's been really my sort of main thinking in the last number of months about two-man.
I haven't so far this year talked about that, and that's a mistake because I didn't use that term, but I really noticed, who did that really well was when Colgate upset Syracuse and Coach Carwick's first year and John Crowley was the offensive coordinator. I remember watching that game and thinking, man, I loved the way that the picker, they were using a ton of picks and the picker was always arriving alone now that I think about it. But the way I described it was he was just kind of changing speeds to get there a lot quicker than his defender, right? So he would kind of go into his guy and jog, and then he'd break it off and burst and go set a pick. And all of a sudden, I tell you what, in the whole game, I bet they only set four or five hard picks because when you sprint and get there, and then the ball carrier knows that that guy's coming, right? The on-ball defender is going to hesitate a little bit, right? Because he's going to run into a pick, even if he's supposed to switch or whatever, he's going to hesitate. So you can slip a lot of those, right? And it becomes, you create an advantage without ever touching a guy, right? You kind of olay him, you run right up to him, and then you kind of slip behind him. And unless, the defense is really, really dialed in on their communication and how they're going to play picks from all over the field, you're going to get a lot of good opportunities. And I thought they did a really good job of that in that game. And it helped them, upset a top 10 team at the time and
yeah.
have a good year. So I haven't put as much thought into that as I should, but I remember watching that game and thinking exactly that. I just never heard the term AAA rated.
Yeah. It is really interesting too. And it also, when you bring up an interesting point of like when to pick, when to slip and when to stick a pick. And all the reads you talked about that, all the different ways that you can play defense against picks. And obviously it's important to know, it's important to scout, it's important to read. But one thing I learned from Colin on the webinar that he did called How to Be the Ultimate Picker that I really hadn't thought about is that basically the most important read, because it's hard to know when you're the picker, is your guy switching or staying? You're not necessarily going to know. You might have an idea based on what they've been doing in the game. But his thing was, if you see the Dodger has a step on their man, slip it.
Yeah.
Which then goes back to why it's so important to have a AAA rating with the ball. You got to figure out a way to get a step on your man, whether it's split dodge away from it and come back to it, whether it's look it off, whether it's use a hezzy. Ryder's unbelievable at bringing people over picks, by the way. Have you noticed that? I mean, it's incredible
he's great at it.
How he positions himself, looks it off, and then is able to get a little bit of a step and invite the guy over the pick, and it's just, they're just done. It's just unbelievable how he does that. But anyways, I thought that was like a really, really cool simplification of the read process. Instead of worrying too much, just like if they got a step, slip it, don't stick it. If they got a step and you stick it, you're getting them covered and you're covered. You're going to get run into. If you slip it, your guy's got a tough decision to make now. Leave you wide open or help or don't help. So it's kind of an interesting topic that I wanted to share.
No, I like that a lot. In fact, I just wrote it down. And I think it's one of those things that the best guys in two-man, and Colin was one of those, they intuitively do that. They realize, well, this pick, the goal of a pick is they're going to create an advantage. That guy already has an advantage. So let me slip this. And now it's a two-on-one somewhere, right? And so, I think that's a really valuable concept. And like I said, I think the best people in two-man rarely set hard picks, because when you set a hard pick, a lot of times it just becomes a switch, unless they're, teams are really hell-bent on keeping matchups. And a switch is just eventually you're just creating another one-on-one, and that's not what you want. You're trying to create you two versus three defender. You're trying to draw basically a third defender, so there's a 4-on-3. Or if you don't draw that, you're trying to create a 2-on-1 or a 1-on-2, which means that the guy who set the pick is now 1-on-0, right? So, I think that's a really valuable way to look at it.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about off-ball too, man.
I'm all ears on that.
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking about it a lot for the last number of years and just sort of watching – watching the game at the, I watched, 95% of the PLL games, watch as many college games as I can, watch a lot of women's, watch a lot of box. And I am pretty blown away by the opportunities in the off ball two man. And so You know, the one look Colin always talks about is the up pick slip, the up pick, the backside up pick backdoor cut. Talks about it all the time. There was a beautiful one by the Water Dogs versus the Cannons. Ended up being a little bit of a blowout of a game. It was an early goal.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you. I've got the clip, but
yeah, I'd love to see that.
But you know, Colin always used to say, like, it's, you know, that the Canadian guys, that's all they would do. I mean, he spent 11 summers playing box in Canada and he would come back. You know, he would listen to these guys talk about it, that it's like a cheat code. And it actually really is. And it's interesting though, because normally when you set picks, you a lot of people want to cut ball side. So imagine a backside up pick, but now you're cutting hard back door. That's the cut that Canadians do a lot that Americans don't do as much, a back door cut. So the ball, say, on the lefty side.
Yep.
And let's just say it's a two-man righty side. And you up pick for the low guy, for the high guy, and he cuts back door.
Yeah, instead of coming right across kind of towards the ball carrier, he's going towards like the back pipe kind of.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, in off-ball, people are oftentimes more likely to switch. But then that opens up the slip. It's really, really hard to guard that. So in any case, my question to you though is, how do you sort of get a balance between what you think you're going to do with off-ball two-man game and then just pure spacing? Because your spacing will be interrupted in the middle of picks at times with yourself covered by one person for a moment. But the idea is you're really trying to get two on one. So, you know, the other way. So, but what's your sort of take on that?
Yeah. So we haven't talked a lot about it. It's something I've wanted to, but again, I've kind of focused on some other stuff first, and the off ball stuff is really, I just want action, right? So I haven't even gotten it. I just want guys getting used to when there's a two man on one side of the field. I want us exchanging. I want someone cutting. I want it making sure that we have an outlet, right? So kind of just big picture things right now. And I want to dive into the weeds of kind of teaching those seals and off ball two man stuff. And I want to throw it back to you on a question, which I hope is allowed on the podcast instead of you questioning me. I feel like in basketball, right? So, you know, as I said, I'm a huge basketball guy. When you set an off ball pick, that defender is usually within a step or two of his guy, right? They're not, the court is smaller. So you can go set a pick right on that guy. In lacrosse, a lot of times a backside defender is pulled in. He might be 10, 15 yards or 7 or 8 yards from his defender. And if you go set a pick on him, it's either an easy switch. By the time your offensive guy cuts somewhere off of that, you know, that guy has time to maneuver around the pick just because you have so much space on the field. So I've fiddled with the idea of almost every off-ball pick should just be more or less sealing your own guy. And then that you're you know, communicating with your teammate that he should be running off you, because it'll essentially become a double pick. Your defender is going to have to maneuver now around two guys as opposed to, you know, just setting an off-ball pick and they just switch it because they're kind of, you know, especially the way that, you know, I've grown up learning about defense. A lot of teams will, if there's action going on, if there's a dodge or a two-man, they'll just switch that and it's almost a zone on the backside. So how do you go about teaching that in terms of, you know, in box, again, it's the same as basketball. That defender is within, you know, two steps of his guy a lot of times. Even if he's helping in towards, you know, what we call the Z line, he's going to be a lot closer, relatively speaking, because the rink or the court is a lot smaller versus having a gigantic lacrosse field box. So how have you gone about teaching that, or how is Colin, you know, and maybe it's a question for him too, but how do you go about creating that matchup when there's just so much space and it's easy to kind of switch or get through picks in that kind of space?
Yeah, well, you know, similar with on ball, you can't really run a two-man game if you don't have your guy engaged. So if you're working off ball two man and you're out, you know, at the top of the box and your guy's at 11 yards, 12 yards with 10 yards, whatever, you're not going to be able to run a game. So everybody has to be engaged. You have to engage your defender. That's part of AAA ratings. You know, you want to make it harder for people to switch, engage them before they're supposed to freeze right? I mean, what is the defense taught to do? It's like, if someone's dodging, we're going to sort of freeze everything up and zone it up. But there's times when that's not happening, and they're staying with matchups, and they're turning their heads, and they're trying to guard their guy and prepare for the potential of a dodge coming up next. Yeah. And so therefore, if you engage your defender, you engage them with actions of cuts of where you're looking, it makes it a lot harder to do that. And so therefore, without the engagement, whether it's on ball or off ball, you're not going to get much out of your two-man game, which means you have to play close.
Yeah. That's the hard part too. You got to be really skilled to be able to do that. If you're going to play,
but you got to be skilled to score goals anyways. You know, I mean, that's the thing is, like, you know, the whole defense is going to pack it in. So if you think you're going to be able to play wide and score a lot of goals, you're probably not going to, because they don't have to guard you out there. And they're not just going to give you, you know, speed to where you want to go. So the best players can play close, more like basketball players. You talk about basketball, you know, the biggest thing basketball players do is they don't run at their guy. They jab and they get big steps with less space by using jabs and not just full sprinting. Now, obviously, there's more space in lacrosse, so there's no reason not to do that. But I would say that the best dodgers are going to be able to have control over their guy with jabs to be able to do it. I mean, that's what Ryder does, is what Jeff did. I mean, that's how they do it. They don't take long runs. Yeah. And they position themselves. They look things off, and they use sort of jabs and timing and hesitations to kind of get what they want. And the same thing is true off ball. So, you know, bottom line is, off ball, you can't. This is why I was sort of talking about that spacing piece, because there's going to be times when you may not have a swing outlet while you're working on an off-ball two-man situation. An off-ball three-man, you can have both. You can, you know, that's the beauty of a three-man side, honestly. Off-ball is that you can have a swing outlet and actions going on at the same time. The advantage of the two-man.
I think that's really important. Having an outlet, I something that I've been, and I learned this from Coach McCabe, that I think is really important offensively, is it sounds so simple, and obviously I'm not revolutionizing the game, but throwing the ball just through X and getting the ball to change, you know, the Z line is what we call the line that splits the field vertically, kind of up the middle of the goal, getting the ball side to side a couple times. And I think through X a lot, because it makes every defender turn their head, at least for a moment, right? Some teams are taught to really look away, but even for a moment, you're going to look and follow the ball, and that can be so valuable. I think every drill we've done, we try to have, even if it's two on twos on the wing or something, we try to have an outlet through X. And when you throw it through, it just, even in when that guy doesn't have, he's not allowed to dodge, he's not allowed to score, he's just a ball mover, it still creates such good opportunities on the backside. So having outlets in both sides, I think, is critical. And that probably means that you're running more always two-man with a three-man off-ball side, as opposed to a three-man side. You know, even if the handedness doesn't always equate, having a three-man off-ball side, to me, is a little bit more important, so that you have an outlet. You're still going to have a guy at X, and you can have some off-ball two-man or some off-ball, you know, picks and screens and stuff, while still having an outlet, because you want that guy to get the ball out of his stick.
Yeah. I don't know if I like it better, but I don't disagree with what you're saying. I would just say, like, on-ball three-man sides are phenomenal too, because, you know, it's taking two people out of the equation for the backside of the defense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you can really, I mean, if you got a three-man side and you break through, there's only going to be two guys. It's going to be a two-on-one over there. So, you know, there's advantages going both ways. The X piece, I love. I couldn't agree more. Getting the ball through X, feeding it from back there. I've been thinking a lot about a lot more off-ball actions across.
I think there's such value, and when you throw it through X, the dive cuts and the cutting to the ball when that happens, or picking, and then if you have a pick and a slip and another guy cutting, you just, you know, you're going to end up, and it's one of those things where even if the defender is a half step late, you can throw it to that guy because he's on your back now. And that guy, as long as he catches it kind of out in front and the guy at X delivers a good ball, you can still score that, right? It may look like he's somewhat covered, but he's not. That you're running away from that guy and he's behind you. You can just create such good opportunities, and you can pull a lot of the defense to one side and still have an outlet on the backside for a really good two-man or a good one-on-one opportunity if you have a guy who you think can win a matchup in space.
Plus, one of the most underrated looks is throwing it to X and throwing it right back to the same side wing, reversing it to the follow. Like literally, like one of the best looks that you can have. The a lot of people get sort of enticed as the dodger to throw it back. And when somebody mirrors you behind, you dodge underneath and there's a mirror, you know, that's following you behind you, you know, they will rotate to that right on time every time. But when you throw that thing to X, a lot of times it's hard to rotate. Number one, if you don't U-turn, if you slide or don't slide, it's even harder, but if there's no U-turn, that guy's going to be open, you know? Yeah. And it's like the U-turn concept of having the guy who was on ball on the dump down to
recover right back.
Is, you know, A is really, really important. But B, you can't even get there though, if the ball's low enough, which is why I think dodging the ball lower and being able to, you know, bounce out and re-attack and taking the ball below 5 yards, that guy's not going to get there. He's not going to be able to recover back up to 12 if he's like U-turning at 3 yards. But the other piece of it that's really interesting, Will, is the no go show U-turn. All right, so let's just imagine you have somebody on the crease showing for a really dangerous redodger on the wing.
A defenseman, a guy showing as a slot.
Right, and let's just say his guy floats out the back. He doesn't follow it. He floats out the back.
Yep.
There's no slide. There's no U-turn because there wasn't a slide, but there has to be because he's never going to get to his guy. And it's like, it's kind of a nuance, you know, that I've noticed over the course of time that a lot of times when you float out the back, a lot of people don't float out the back as much as they used to either, though. It's all follow the dodge with a mirror or a whip or whatever. But when you float out the back, if the middy whose guy is following doesn't recognize that he's got to get the no-go show defender to U-turn back to his guy while he gets to the backside, you'll run into the exact same problems with no U-turn on that recovery. Yeah, draw it up. Check it out. It's an interesting concept.
I'm a visual guy. I'm going to have to draw that up.
I'm an X and O in my head sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that's impressive. You just manipulated a whole defense in your head. I respect it.
Well, back up, I mean, it's funny because when I was thinking about when we were talking about coaching the 2013 in the summer of 2013, we coached the 3D Colorado 2016s. That was the team. They were ninth graders. And we ran Cuse. It was the first time. I love that offense. And I actually like, you know, called to learn it from Coach Donahue. And he gave me the whole thing. And in that offense, there was sometimes the crease follows behind the dodge and sometimes it floats out while you're in that four-man midi offense. And that's really where I learned, like, you know, on both sides of the ball that having both of those options are so huge. And it seems like everyone has gone to the crease follow to give probably space for rollbacks and stuff, which is great. But the crease float out puts a lot of pressure on, particularly if you don't U-turn and a crease float out, you're going to have a backside guy wide open.
Yeah.
And it happens on the no-go, which is the little new
one. No, I like that. We did that at Notre Dame. We had an offense kind of 20 out. Was a 2-2-2 and the dodge and the crease, you know, the attack might have a specific rotation or something. And the midfielder on the crease would go out away from the dodge. So you have that skip and you see it, to be honest, you see it, everybody runs a version of kind of stack, right? Where you have those three guys in a line and you have a big top center dodge, you have first guy pops, other guy goes away. And, you know, if you don't cover it or you don't slide from the right guy, there's an easy through lane throw into that guy who went away from the dodge, you know? So no, it's a great simple action. You're right. It kind of gets underutilized. It's such a simple thing, just going away from it. But everyone feels like they should go towards the ball. You know, it's just a kind of a natural thing. You certainly see it like when you're coaching youth. And when I was coaching high school, is everyone kind of gravitates towards the ball. You got to fight that urge and kind of move away from it because you're going to give yourself more space, you know, and you're going to create distance between you and your defender.
A lot easier to recover. It's a lot easier to show and recover to the mirror, get in the way and get back. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it is. It's a little easier. So I think it's a good changeup. All right, let's talk a little EMO.
Oh, I'm intrigued by this because I've put some thought into it, but we haven't done much EMO yet. So again, I'm kind of all ears for you. But yeah, I think one thing that I really liked that actually Coach Byrne taught me at Harvard is, he basically broke down EMO, and he does this, in teaching defense to help kind of simplify offense is, it's not the whole six man offense. There's like little actions. It's action within action is what he calls it, right? And so, he had a list of, 15 different kind of actions within actions for EMO. And even before we, had a scout a team to scout, like in the fall, like I was running the scout team man up, the laser show, at Harvard. And we would just kind of run those little actions, and we'd run them from different sets. We'd run
What
them
are some
from,
examples?
so the example like UVA and a lot of teams ran the double cut, right? So you're in a 2-3-1, guy catches the ball at X, you have the top two guys dive, and they can exchange, they can kind of cross and dive, or they can just dive at the pipes. One guy releases out, and that creates, so double cut is one. He had a guy, Colin Igoe, was a player at Notre Dame a while back who would do this really well. So they called it an Igoe cut. But essentially, you see, again, a lot of teams do it. Everybody kind of does a version of the same stuff, whether it's disguised better or differently, run from different sets. But an Igoe is, you're kind of carrying towards an attackman or a low guy. He starts to clear through, and he just kind of button hooks right on top of the crease. Right as soon as he runs by that defenseman, that guy then goes to the ball. He button hooks, and that's a long kind of pull from the next guy. Duke ran. Who did they run it for? I stole it from them, and I ran it at Woodinville, what now we call the pump and spin, right? So you three man rotation, throw it to the top center guy. He looks one way, he pumps. Some guys are dramatic and literally spin all the way around. The three man rotation rotates again. A guy dives in and seals that top center guy, and you have a shooter coming off the crease, right? Who might have started in the crease spot. He rotates one spot. As the guy pumps and
Yeah,
spins, he comes up to the righty shooter
the
spot.
RB360.
So, yeah, is that what you called it?
No, but that's what
RB360.
that's
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah,
combine
Ryan
those
Brown's a
things.
good guy to run that for. Yeah, exactly. I can't remember who Duke would run that for, but they ran that, and I took it, and we scored a lot of goals at Woodinville off of that action. So that's kind of I kind of liked that. I like just kind of almost teaching guys. Again, it's not a set play. And I see the value in man up of set plays, but it's just so kind of the antithesis of how I want to coach offense that I feel like it's hard to then script a very specific one look through man up. So I'd rather have kind of these actions and maybe be able to flow through a few of them, right? And some teams, I want to say like Colgate, Carwick also learning from Coach Byrne, and I think Princeton did a really good job of flowing between in a minute possession, a minute man up. They might run three of those different actions. They might run a pump and or a double cut into a pump and spin into a four-man carry kind of thing, right? Or have an Igoe cut at the end of it, right? Brown did a really good job. They had a version of the pump and spin, but it was a two-man rotation instead of three. And they scored on us versus it with it. So that's kind of my thought right now. I don't know. What are your thoughts on man up? What do you like? Is there specific kind of actions within actions? Is there sets that you like playing out of? What are your thoughts?
I mean, I think all those actions are great. I'm sure I would want to teach all of them, at one point in time. I kind of look at it more from 50,000 feet, and just and I look at it that you have to really be able to draw and dump, like really draw and dump.
Yep.
Now, I think this is the when a man up is faltering, it's because people aren't really drawing.
Yeah.
Not drawing, they're not recognizing if they're in a gap, and they're not making somebody commit with a check. Usually it's because they're being told to stay wide,
Yeah.
don't get checked. But a draw and dump isn't just drawing and dumping for a shooter. It can be, of course, and that's when we think of draw and dump, we think of that. But draw and dump on man up is that you are taking a defender out of their next responsibility. That could include skipping it right past them. When they commit to you, you take
Yeah.
them out of a position and you move the ball and draw a check. They're not going to be in a skip pass lane immediately. They're going to try, but they're not going
Yeah.
to get it. And so that to me, you know, there's that, there's learning how to skip the ball through actions and around people that I look at as just absolutely critical. Got to be able to, you know, you got to be able to throw the, but you got to be able to skip it. You're not just going to skip the ball though, because people are going to pick it off. And so you have to do it. You know, you watch the Canadians, they're just incredible at skipping the ball through traffic, through cuts and picks and slips and around defenders. Grant Amon's phenomenal at it. He throws skips around people. You can't see him. The same way of a screen shot, a goalie can't see. Defenders that are trying to pick off passes on the backside or adjacent can't see a screen pass either. And so, you know, to me, and I actually did a webinar on this stuff. I'll send it to you. But it's, I think
that'd be awesome.
Those are the most important part. And then all of those looks are great. And obviously this isn't mutually exclusive. And I might say the last one is being able to get a wall pass, get the ball inside and out.
Yeah.
Able to make that pass, you know, getting it inside and out isn't the hardest part. It's delivering the ball inside to out with the concepts we were talking about before of being able to like fully make people draw and dump and drag them around or carry them around and being able to get it inside out. Once you have your, you know, once you have your ability to truly draw and dump, to truly skip, and to get it inside and out, it kind of covers the defenses that you're going to face, which is if it's four man, you're going to have more drop and skip. And if it's five man, you're going to have more soft spot in the middle. And you got to, you know, and be able to skip and draw and dump.
Yeah. No, I like that a lot. I like, kind of the simplicity of those three things. And I think you're right. I don't know how many actions we'll get to in the fall. I think that the most underutilized thing sometimes in man up is just being able to play out of a 3-3. You're 6-on-5. If you can draw and dump and you can skip the ball effectively, and if you have good stick work and good spacing, you have an extra guy. You should be able to generate a pretty good shot. And once you're really good at that, then you can start adding in actions and guys will understand. Yeah. You're right. The concept of drawing and dumping is the start and skipping. And then you can add actions. But once they have those skills, you can kind of do anything. It's like we're talking about offensively. You want to teach the skills and the decision-making before you kind of put specific actions of what guys have to do, because, you know, that can always be scouted and covered. If you're just reading and reacting and making decisions, that's constantly going to be kind of a battle, an offensive versus defensive battle, because they're doing the same thing.
Yeah, no doubt. And then obviously, you know, you got to be able to shoot. And
there's no doubt. Got to be able to stretch the field a little bit. Got to be able to, you know, put the ball past a goalie and sometimes handle the ball in tight space and, you know, finish the ball from the low corners and get to the front. So that's obviously something that you got to work on.
Here's a question for you that I ask some athletes that I work with. Would you rather have an open shot or somebody approaching you?
I mean, me specifically or like my players?
Generally. It's kind of a trick question.
No, I know exactly where you're going with this. I just to play devil's advocate, I'd rather have an open shot.
Fair enough. I think the argument of shooting around a person is undeniable, though. It opens up.
There's certain value.
You're going to be hard. You're going to have more range. Your 8-yard range is going to go to like at least 8.5 yards if you're shooting around a screen. No, joking. Yep. Probably 9.5. I mean, you're going to gain it because.
But here's the thing about the open shot that I actually learned from you and my dad, because again, I wasn't a great shooter in college, is if you're open, you can mess with the timing and the rhythm a little bit more, right? You can catch and quick release, or you can crow hop, and every goal is used to that kind of, all right, crow hop release, and instead you crow hop in release delay. And a goalie's going to kind of, they're going to freeze a little bit. I actually ended up scoring a few goals my senior year doing that from, probably outside of my range because it just,
because you had the time.
It's your whole. Yeah, exactly. Cause I didn't have anyone in front of me. If I had someone in front of me, I didn't have the time to do that.
That is what everybody thinks. That's why everybody practices ad nauseum, shoot it as fast as humanly possible. Because it seems like if you have an approaching defender, you won't have time. But actually, when you pump a shot, what do?
Yeah.
They give you a window for shooting it. They jump in the way. They jump out of the way. They duck. They close their eyes. They put their heads down. I mean, watch. And I encourage anybody, watch any game and watch every shot and see what everybody does. Almost never are they like watching you and defending, you know, they're doing something to get in the way of that shot or get out of the way of that shot. And I'm not going to say that every single time you could pump it and find it. But if you watch the Canadians, they almost never shoot a quick release shot unless it's sort of a backside one-timer into an empty net. Because in box, you're never going to score if you don't move the goalie. And the whole point you're making of my open shot gave me more time and it could allow me to delay my release so I could hitch again is what you can actually do all day long in field lacrosse. And it happens all the time. And it doesn't mean the quick release isn't great. It is. There's times when you will not score if you don't get it off quickly. There's no doubt about that. But it's way more often that you actually have time to hitch and multiple hitch. And those multiple hitches are like the goals that you see, Jeff Teeter or Connor Fields or all these Canadians, you know, all the time. I call it a palace pump because Johnny Palace was this guy that played. Remember that guy, Johnny Palace? Probably like 10 years ago.
The name sounds familiar.
He was like, played junior lacrosse for the for Six Nations, and he was winning three NLL championships in a row. And he was the first guy that I really noticed doing the shot all the time, which is hard pump, lift. You know, the hard pump and then lift allows you to find a screen, allows you to get shots off.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's watching Tahoga, watching Stotts, watching all of these, you know, Canadians. I mean, Tommy Schreiber does it all the time now.
Yeah.
Pump, low, lift. You know, you watch like Brendan O'Neill, his release is more of a lift too.
He does that really well, that wind lift. Up low, and then he brings it up over the high. It looks like it's going to be a sidearm shot.
Yeah. And it brings
his it is, up. His is really his deceptive.
His delayed release charge too. But you can do that same thing with a pump that you can with a lift. The smooth lift of low high windup. And it delays the release, and that's what destroys the goalies because they're expecting the ball to come out at a certain time. And when it comes out late, you know, it's the part of deception a lot of people don't really think about. You always think about where you're looking, but where the goalie thinks it's going, but when it's coming, it's unbelievable how hard it is when the goalie like moves before the shot goes.
Well, and I think you can. Part of deception, right? And you call it deception. Like I kind of talk about it as the rhythm of your shooting motion or your, you know, your offense in general, right? I think once you establish and you kind of can feel what your rhythm is and, you know, understand that about yourself and about your offense, right? If it's a you know, 6-on-6 thing, then you can really manipulate that rhythm, right? Like, you know, you can speed guys up or slow guys down. You see Dodgers do that all the time, right? Like you know, deception is one way to talk about it. The other way is, you know, you burst by a guy, but then you slow down, right? The slide now is like, wait, do I slide? That guy, he doesn't look beat all of a sudden, right? He looked like he was going to be beat. He's kind of beat. He's kind of stuck in the middle, right? So I think I talk about rhythm a lot, ironically, as a guy who has no rhythm. But I really felt it when I played, right? You just kind of have this overall sense of what's supposed to happen and the flow of it. And once you feel that, then you can manipulate, you can speed it up, slow it down. And you kind of manipulate it to your will and you make the defense have to cater to that. I think that's what individually you can do with a shooting motion with, you know, the pump, you know, even if you're going to release it from the same point the whole time, if you release it a half second late or, you know, get it off a lot quicker than a goalie might expect. You know, you can do the same thing in offense, right? And I think that's in two-man, you can do that, right? Sometimes, you know, like we were talking about, you know, the AAA, you know, a guy bursts in to set a pick. All of a sudden, he thinks it's this casual two-man. That guy's sprinting away from me. He's like, holy fuck. Yep. I don't know if I can say that on the podcast. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, same with the guy coming off the pick, right? You see point guards do it so well. Sometimes they just burst off of it and they're like, I'm going to run through. That guy's going to hedge, or I know how he's going to play the pick. I'm just going to burst off of it and I'm going to, you know, kind of run by him and catch him off guard. And sometimes he gets to the pick and he slows down and he steps away, or you like to teach stepping kind of almost into it to bring that guy with you. I think that's really hard. So I like stepping away to try to pull those two guys to you. But either way, you're doing the same thing, right? You're trying to manipulate two guys and you're manipulating the rhythm of how you play. And I think that's a really valuable thing.
No doubt. All right, man. I think we got to call it. We got to do this again, though.
I was going to say, I don't know if anyone's going to listen to this. It's just me.
No,
and you,
I know,
you know,
but you know what? Just recording a conversation we would have been having.
That's it. I was going to say, we just had this the other day anyway, so we might as well put it out there and see if anyone cares.
Now, and the next time we got to get into the story when Darius Kilgore picked you up in the at the Nyer on the Lake camp, picked you up and turned you upside down and shook all your money out of your pockets. But we'll get into that.
I'm trying to be a professional here, Jamie. We don't need to get into those stories of my youth. Those I thought those were supposed to be.
You're in college, man.
As I get older. Listen, I gained Darius's respect. I tried to wrestle him, and you know it didn't go well. But I gained his respect. I'm a huge fan of Darius. We got to get into air. We didn't even get to talk Air Force either. We, you know, I gotta be able to give a plug for them.
Everything you're going to be doing, but yeah, we'll follow. Hey, Will, always a pleasure, man. Best of luck, and I'll see you when I get out there at the end of the month.
You're the best, Jamie. Excited to see you, man.
Later, buddy.
See ya.